Welcome to Light Bites, an occasional podcast from Leeds Institute for Teaching Excellence at the University of Leeds.
Episodes will be hosted by members of the Light team.
And we'll be showcasing the scholarship of teaching and learning from across the university.
Hello, welcome to the latest episode of Light Bites. My name is Robert Averies from the Leeds Institute for Teaching Excellence. I'm joined today by Andy Curtin.
Hello, thanks for having me.
No worries, you're welcome. And Andy Curtin has recently completed a Light Fellowship called Removing Dominance and Gatekeeping in Higher Education. And that's what Andy is here to talk to you about today. So perhaps to get things started, you could tell us a little bit about what you do at the University of Leeds.
Sure, yeah. So my main job role is, the title is Lecturer in Applied Ethics. So I work at IDEA, it's the Ethics Centre. So we do kind of interdisciplinary teaching, research and consultancy in ethics and ethics in society type of issues. So, yeah, most of my job role, I'm a teaching and scholarship lecturer. So I'm predominantly teaching based. And basically, we teach ethics relevant to disciplines across the university. So we might be in engineering or business or dentistry or medicine, any discipline that, you know, has a bit of ethics relevant to their course. People like me come in and we talk to students about ethics and get them discussing it and seeing how their work and kind of professional practice and maybe their future careers raises ethical issues and what kinds of things they'll have to navigate in the future for themselves and, yeah, what to think about. So that's my sort of main job, is a lot of teaching, but I also do research. So my sort of published work is on the nature of trust and what it means to trust people and why trust has got this kind of ethical or moral significance to it. So when you trust someone, it doesn't just matter to you that they do the thing, it sort of matters to you that they said they would do the thing. And it's, you know, if they let you down, then that's a kind of interpersonal kind of wronging. So my work will explore all that. And so how people work together, why it matters to them that people do what they say they're going to do, and kind of looking at that in terms of interpersonal relationships, but also in social structures, societies, corporations, all that sort of stuff. I think about trust a lot and, yeah, how society works and how we fit together, basically.
Not to dumb the conversation down at all, but I'm really glad that I held up my end of the bargain with this podcast.
Right.
Given I would do that several months ago.
If you'd have cancelled, I wouldn't have minded.
So what motivated you to start your Light Fellowship?
Yeah, so probably, like I said, the fact that I was doing a lot of teaching as my main job role. So I've taught now for 10 years or a bit over 10 years. So I used to teach as part of my PhD at University of Manchester. Now been at Leeds for 6-7 years, teaching a lot. And you get used to, I guess, thinking about, you know, what is it that I'm doing? What is it that I'm trying to get students to do? And sort of reflecting on how, to me, the practice of teaching in a university felt. And I was sort of struck by this feeling that oftentimes I felt like I was being kind of unfair to students, or that what I was getting them to do was kind of mysterious. And that's partly, so like I said, my teaching involves going into these other disciplines where students don't really know what philosophy or ethics amounts to. They don't really care about it often, or they're not immediately sort of on board with the point of what you're trying to get them to do. So you might only be teaching them for just that 1 hour session or something, and then you don't see them again. So when you're put in that kind of position, like I was, you're really forced to think about, okay, what is the kind of bare essential thing that I'm trying to get them to do, and what's the value of it, and how can I transmit to them that value and that function, or, you know, the sort of practice of it in such a short space of time? Because I don't have the whole session to just go on about you know, why you should care about this. It's often like 10 minutes or 5 minutes, if that, right at the start. Mm. So just doing all this teaching, and maybe that also involves getting them to do some assessment as well on some of that teaching. So a lot of disciplines, they might have kind of a small ethics portion for the students to complete as part of the overall assessment in that module. And then so I was thinking a lot about how do I convey this to them, the value of this, and then the assessment that I'm doing, what is it actually doing for them? What is the point of this ethics assessment? So I'm giving them this marking criteria, and I'm explaining to them, this is what we're after. And it felt very sort of top down and imposed, like you just have to do these things to tick this box, and then you can move on, you can forget you ever met me, that kind of thing. So do all this teaching, think about all that. You think, what is the point in this? And then I had another experience. It was 2020, 2021, during the pandemic. I learned to drive. And so this like period where I was thinking about what is all this, what we're doing, I was learning to drive at the same time, and something struck me about the way that doing driving lessons was very different to my experience of teaching students in university. And at this very sort of get-go of doing driving lessons, you're aware, right, this thing that you're aiming towards, this is going to come at the end, and it's going to have all these maneuvers that you're asked to complete. And what we're going to do in these lessons, we've maybe got 20, 30 lessons, we're just going to do these maneuvers over and over again, so it becomes part of your muscle memory. And I thought, a lot of that is very different to this sort of in-person teaching that I'm doing, where maybe I'm doing a lecture on a topic, I'm doing a seminar, and maybe seminars revolve around students discussing questions, and maybe I'm asking them, you know, air your views and think about others' views. Maybe in a lecture I'm sort of giving them some theories and some background of this issue that we're discussing. But the sort of connection between that in-person teaching and the final thing I then hit them with maybe weeks later, where, you know, I've got this essay for you to write. The things didn't seem very connected in my mind in a way which is very different to, you know, the driving lessons are going to practice these maneuvers that you do over and over again, do a test on them. And so you see this sort of pathway and this trajectory, and you experience your progress, you experience yourself getting better at it. So I was just like, yeah, what is the connection between these things? And yeah, I was like, how can we get teaching done in a way so it's more like the driving lessons, basically, and more transparent and more kind of giving the students the sort of power to take control of their learning? So all these kinds of things.
Yeah. And you spoke to the multidisciplinarity of your work, but also I think this approach lends itself well to a wide range of disciplines in terms of how we can shift those power dynamics. So if you're listening to this and you're teaching, you're designing a curriculum, this, keep listening, because I think this work is really relevant. Yeah. Obviously, you adapt it and you interpret it in your own way, but...
Yeah. So that was the thing I was thinking about. So we all have our different disciplines. We're all getting students to do something that we want them to be able to do, which is a kind of essential part of this discipline. But how does teaching and assessment kind of relate to that overall thing that we do as academics, or you know, what people do in society when, let's say, I'm a philosopher, but academic philosophy doesn't have a monopoly on being philosophical. Like, that's something anyone can do. So how does learning to do it in a university environment relate to this kind of more general human practice? And I guess the same is true of other disciplines. You know, you can study all kinds of things at a university, and it's not just training you in doing this particular reified academic thing. It's supposed to be sort of this widely applicable human thing. So, yeah, how is it, I guess the thing I was really wrestling with was, how is it that I can convey to students, get them hooked, and get them seeing the value of doing this method or technique in this academic level, that it's not just a load of theories or expectations in a marking criteria. It's this like essential human thing that is supposed to enrich our lives in some way.
It would be really good at this point, I think, for listeners to hear a little bit about how this was channeled into your Light Fellowship in particular. So what sorts of, I don't know, research questions or aims did you have? And then how did you go about investigating it?
Yeah, so this was a thing that shifted over time a little bit. So because I started off the project and the proposal for the project was this quite sort of blue sky thing in a way, which was, you know, how do you address this relation where you're keeping standards that you're asking students to meet mysterious, or you're sort of not directly training them in it, or you know, you hit them with assessments that seem to bear some relation to what they do in in-person teaching, but it's not necessarily clear. That kind of broad idea, then making that into a tractable thing which you can do some research on or do a project on exploring how to address that, I essentially really struggled to come up with a set of research aims or a research plan in a way which I felt fit the kind of light formula or model. So I kind of went into this being like, I want to explore this and maybe do some experimental forms of teaching where I essentially leave it up to the students to do everything. And then I kind of hit institutional stumbling blocks. Well, there's limits to what you can reasonably mess around with in terms of how teaching or assessment works. So I had to think about what I was going to do in the restrictions of working in the student education machinery. But then I was also thinking, okay, what is it I'm actually trying to test or find out? So I kind of came up with various versions of a bunch of survey questions to try and get views from students about how they felt, yeah, their sort of sense of ownership over their subject was. So I remember coming up with survey questions about, do you feel like you're being trained as a practitioner of your discipline, or to what extent do the lecturer's standards seem transparent to you, or to what extent do you think those standards that they're asking you to meet are the result of just preferences of the lecturers themselves, or do they relate to some kind of external thing that's like important in the world? So again, thinking back to the driving lesson stuff, I was like, it's a clear way in which you can drive successfully because that's a matter of the way the world is and the way that a car functions. You can either do it well or you can't. Whereas a lot of the time, and this was something I experienced as a student, when you get your feedback on a piece of work back on an assessment, you're kind of looking at this feedback going like, okay, so I did that well, I didn't do that well. But you can't quite see why. It's like, you know, oh, you needed to do more critical analysis. Okay, I can kind of vaguely understand what that means, but not exactly sure. So it's all, yeah, this way of trying to figure out, how do I extract from students their feelings about this stuff? Coming up with survey questions. I was also coming up with survey questions for teaching staff. Do they think about these kinds of issues? You know, what do you see? I was thinking of survey questions like, what do you see your role as a lecturer or teacher? Do you see yourself as kind of bringing students into the discipline, or just seeing whether they should be allowed into it? Or to what extent do you see yourself as handing over the kind of methods or the tools that are relevant for your discipline? Or to what extent do you see yourself as ensuring the integrity of those tools, or ensuring that they're not mishandled? So I was kind of, yeah, I was kind of interested in all these questions about what's going on inside students and teachers' heads. But I essentially got very little traction in getting that kind of approach off the ground. So found it a struggle to get a kind of empirical route to thinking about my question. And I hit many different stumbling blocks, essentially kept stalling on it, and kind of at the end ran out of time. And what happened then was speaking to Light about it, saying, oh, well, I could do this kind of last ditch thing where maybe I do some observations of teaching and just write some reflections on that. And I can't remember exactly, but that didn't seem to get off the ground either. And then I said, oh, okay, well, what I could do is just write a piece about how I'm thinking about all this, sort of write a philosophical conceptual piece, maybe run a workshop, because I know people who think about this stuff within philosophy. And that got the thumbs up. So I guess in the end, my approach sort of started off quite blue sky, and then I spent a bunch of time trying to figure out, and I was a bit in the weeds of, I need to make this empirical or quantitative or qualitative in some way. And in the end, I looped back around to, oh, I could just do the thing that I'm trained to do as a philosopher and think about it conceptually and write something and maybe get a bunch of people together to think in the same way, to sort of reflect on what we're doing and come up with some new ways of thinking and, yeah, expanding on everything.
Can I ask you about the workshop in a bit more detail? Because as I know, it was really successful for you and has led to some potential ongoing work in this area.
Yeah, people said they had a really nice time and that it was a good workshop. I tried to make sure that everyone feels like basically it's worthwhile them dragging themselves out of bed and spending an entire day in a room full of people they might not know.
And some external participants as well.
Yeah, sure, yeah. So I had someone called Leonie Smith, who's at Lancaster. So I used to, when I was at Manchester, she was doing a PhD in philosophy. She started just as I was sort of finishing it, but we've kept in touch and remained friends. So she works on issues around working class representation in philosophy. And so a bunch of the stuff that I was thinking about, lots of people who are concerned about issues in around class, these ideas really resonated with them because working class students come to university lacking this kind of, I guess, cultural capital or tacit knowledge about what's expected in a kind of university environment or what doing an academic discipline is kind of about, in a way which more middle or upper class students, they don't lack that knowledge. So yeah, Leonie came to talk about that. And I had some people that then Leonie put me in touch with. So her collaborator, Anne-Marie McCallion, who's at Manchester Metropolitan. So they did some collaborative talks together, and a PhD student from Manchester called Lucia Duda. And she was looking at the sort of styles of analytic philosophy and what kinds of approaches it prescribes. And yeah, and then I had my friend Aisling Crean, who I co-authored some work on trust with a bunch of years ago. She came and spoke on the same stuff. And yeah, it was a successful workshop. And what it's led to is a set of ongoing conversations. And I'm putting together right now a proposal for an edited collection that I've got a publisher interested in. And it's just going to be on this same stuff that the workshop was on, you know, styles, standards in philosophy, but also other disciplines. And essentially the question was, and this was the question of the workshop, who gets to decide on what the standards are in an academic discipline? Because, you know, as teachers, we all enforce and enact these kinds of mechanisms for imposing standards on students, but we kind of do that because, well, that's our job. You know, I've got the essays to set, I've got the marking criteria I need to assign. We just kind of do it, and it's something that, yeah, reinforces and perpetuates the same standards. It molds students in that image, and they come up through that same system, so it selects for certain sets of standards. So I guess the workshop question and what I'm getting people to, collaborators in this edited collection to write about is, well, who decides on those standards? Why are they how they are for this particular discipline? What do those standards mean? And are those standards ones that serve or resonate with or that are valuable to all different kinds of people who can study a discipline? Because those are sort of questions that aren't particularly reflected on, and the mechanisms of teaching and assessment don't allow any kind of give in those standards, because it's just, well, that's just what you have to do.
Yeah. If you don't mind, I'd love to just read something from your light snapshot.
Yeah, sure, go ahead.
Okay,
yeah.
Cringe-worthy.
Oh, yeah, go on.
So I think it's great. So you describe your worry that as a marker, you're at some level acting as a gatekeeper for disciplinary standards that are not open to question or challenge. So the process by which the discipline selects new recruits, in fact, feeds the power of a dominant gatekeeping demographic who can set the rules how they like. Through your fellowship, the workshop you did and the conceptual work you've done, what's your sense of this now in terms of some of the tensions around this and potential routes out of this sort of dichotomy?
Yeah, one thing that's become clear to me is that, oh, actually, these questions do resonate with lots of people in lots of other disciplines. So I've spoken to people working in languages here at Leeds, and they were saying, you know, this is stuff that we really wrestle with, because in teaching languages, what we're doing is we're saying there's a prescribed way of using a language, but that's not how languages work. They're things in the world, in the wild. So what we're doing is there a way in which we're enforcing a certain kind of way of using a language, and that's imposing a kind of dominant group's interests in how that language works on students. There's been people I've spoken to who work in of English literature and English language who talk about the ways in which you should or shouldn't analyse texts and how those standards get conveyed to students. So, yeah, that's what's surprised me is, and what I've learned is, oh, it's not just me in my head thinking about this. And it was revealed to me as well, there was a bunch of areas of philosophy where people in my discipline ostensibly had been thinking about this, but because of the sort of academic route, I guess I came up through as an undergraduate and then as a graduate student, I just wasn't exposed to that work. So a lot of work in Black American philosophy, they've written about this for decades, and it's been an ongoing thing. And I was sort of like, oh, okay, yeah, all right. So it's not just me. It is like it's got resonance with loads of different groups. In terms of ways out of it or ways to address it, I guess the kind of quick answer to that is, well, at least we need to be aware of this as a thing that we're doing, and to then, you know, it's a bit of a cliche thing to say, but at least we're starting conversations about it, I suppose. And then through that, my hope is that we can kind of look at, and I suspect it might be quite simple, the kinds of things we can do. So if we look at how we teach and how we set assessments, so long as we build in some ways for students to think about and reflect on what the value of those standards are, maybe get them to... And so something I want to do in future is to get students to a position where they feel like they can make mistakes more. So by that, I mean they can mess around with the standards. So it's through, essentially how I learn is through trying to break something and trying to see how it goes wrong. And then I go, oh, okay, so it has to do that because otherwise it's like this. Whereas a university kind of path and assessment path, because it's very much like, okay, you do the actual bits of work, they tend to count for marks. So there's not much way in which they can forgivably mess up. It all sort of counts. So in that sense, there's no, there's a lot of incentives against failure and against sort of seeing the value of the ways things should be done by seeing how to break them or seeing how they go wrong. So yeah, I'd like to see if there's scope to of allow students to be more playful with standards and to get a sense of what they mean, and whether that's so certain kinds of teaching techniques I used over the years in thinking about all this stuff was to just in-person teaching sessions get them doing little exercises, little bits of work that maybe it's just like a mini bit of an essay or a mini presentation. It's not, you know, I guess it's classed as formative, but it might just be one shot and it might just be within that session, and they write it, we talk about it, we forget about it in the next session. And to do that over and over again, and to get them not being scared to kind of be wasteful with their work and to just do little bits, see what works, see what doesn't work. And then through that, they get more familiar with the standards and maybe appreciate the value of, like, okay, this is why critical, this is what both what critical analysis means, and this is maybe why critical analysis is done in this particular format that the lecturer is asking me to follow.
Fantastic. Yeah, I can think of several Light Fellowships, both ongoing and completed, like yours, that draw upon critical pedagogy as a very common one, actually, growing at Light. And I can see how that fits within that these wider pieces of work that people are doing across a range of different disciplines.
Yeah. I've spoken to a bunch of other people in who are doing Light Fellowships, and, yeah, often there's some kind of sense of there needs to be more scope for this kind of playfulness, formative assessment, if you want to call it. But to me, it's just about getting them doing it, because it's not all just this transmission of, all right, you need to learn these things and then repeat them back to me at this time. It's like any kind of learning. I just think about, you know, how even sort of primitive monkeys copying one another. Yeah. You know, a monkey with a stick jams it into the termite hole, pulls out termites, the other one observes, goes, oh, okay, so that's the way to do it, and it's all very sort of clear. Whereas, a lot of university setup seems to not have that kind of core structure to it built in.
I think there are certain contemporary challenges as well that make this particularly important.
Absolutely, yeah. So the way that the university system works and the sort of a lot of this fellowship got me just thinking about what is the function and what is the role of a university now.
Good.
And it seemed to me that a big looming thing that I need to grapple with is essentially it's a ranking or sorting mechanism. So it's society has this big interest in basically people coming out of university education pathway being rubber stamped with something that then can inform employers or other, you know, other bodies, what do I make of this person, and where should they go, and what's their sort of significance or their sort of value or role in society. So university isn't necessarily, it's incidentally about education, but it seems to me, well, the primary function actually, because you can learn yourself and you can go off and learn from YouTube and whatever. Yeah. It seems like the primary function is this kind of approval mechanism or rubber stamping thing.
Yeah, it's almost as if the university doesn't exist in its own vacuum. It's part of society and it's intricately connected and plays a constitutive role in what happens outside of the university, right?
Absolutely. I mean, someone more clued up on the history of the university as an institution and sort of how they started would probably be able to interject at this point and say some nice thing like, yeah, that's because...
Please write to us at Light. At least.icg.
Exactly, of course, the university was the thing that fed the higher levels of politics. And I mean, it's still to some extent like that. Not every university, but...
I think, and I don't want to sound like I'm just sort of here to promote Light Fellowships, although I guess that's part of the...
That's a fair enough purpose to have.
But one of the things that I notice working with Light Fellows is often many of the outcomes, if you like, are ways of thinking and ways of thinking differently, not always restricted to the particular aims of the fellowship itself. So sometimes it's teleological like this, but it's also spans off in loads of different areas, and that's really exciting and good to hear. I've mentioned Andy's Light Snapshot, which you can find on his Light profile. Are there any other outputs stemming from your fellowship that listeners can expect to engage with in the future?
Yeah, so I've got plans to put together. So during the fellowship, I kind of did little conference talks where I broke down some, they're not like revolutionary, but some teaching techniques I was using in my own teaching. Those resonated with particular people, and I think I shared them with various kind of school academic leads for inclusive practice in other schools. So those resources did take on a bit of a life beyond just my own hard drive. So I'm going to compile those as a little resource, and I did try and find time to write a toolkit or some kind of, you know, implications for practice thing, which I was going to share. I've not had time to do that yet. What my main focus has been in going forwards, and what the main sort of output I'm hoping for this to be, is that editor collection. So I'm currently putting that together and compiling abstracts from people I've spoken to who are on board with it. And yeah, very soon I'm hoping to approach the publisher with that. So they're already on board and they're very keen on it, but I need to get the next stage sort of sorted, which is they go, yep, all right, now go ahead and write it based on all these abstracts. So that's the main thing I'm going to be working on.
Cool.
And yeah, I have to write I have to turn the talk I did at the workshop into a written piece, which is proving challenging, because that talk was all about what happens if I do a talk and I don't follow the conventions of my discipline. does it still count as a talk in that discipline? And do I still say something? So I'm trying to sort of translate that form into a written piece and it not just be a complete sort of misfire or failure.
Yeah.
Yeah. I still want them to publish it. That's the thing. So, yeah.
These are the judgments that we often have
to consider.
A couple more questions before we finish from my perspective. One is, do you have any advice for anyone considering conducting pedagogical research or a Light Fellowship?
Yeah. So advice based on my experience, I guess, is reckon seriously with workloading from your main job role. One of the main struggles I had was protecting time for the Light Fellowship. My main job role kind of contracts and expands in terms of its obligations in over the course of a year and a semester in this really kind of non-linear way. And the crumple zone in my workload time that took the impact was my own research time and this Light buyout time. So that was a real struggle. So I'd think seriously about getting commitments maybe from, you know, your line manager in your substantive role. Can I take this morning and block it out for me to work on my fellowship? Do maybe more belligerent things like put on an out of office, do like go into another room or something to sort of switch your mental framework. And then the other thing, so I described the kind of roundabout route I went through in planning the project and figuring out what it was. I mean, in my case, maybe that was a sort of inevitable thing that just had to play out. But if you can, go into your project with a kind of clear sense of what's the technique, what's the method, what's the thing that you're excited to do. So I think one of the problems with the way I was sort of approaching this in the sort of middle bits where I was trying to make it into an empirical thing, it's just, well, that wasn't the thing that excited me in the first place necessarily. The main thing that excited me as a philosopher was to just think about these bigger questions and to try and square them in my own mind in a way that I could then write about, and in a way which wouldn't be kind of completely divorced from practice, but in a way which wasn't necessarily about kind of empirically verifying anything or getting any data. I think the way I've worked in my teaching practice has been kind of follow my intuition and then reflect on it and write some reflections and then do different things. But I didn't necessarily need to get any data, I think, in my case. Mm. So, yeah, just think about what's the thing that you're good at and what you're excited to do, I guess.
Yeah. And I say, if you're listening and considering this, talk to us as well.
Yeah. So I got loads of help in the end from Robert, Lucy and Sinead. It was all very much appreciated in the end. Yeah.
This is a nice segue to my final question, which is a bit of an off-the-cuff kind of meta Pedres question, which is, and I'm only partly asking this because I'd love to work with and to see more pedagogical research from your disciplinary area, what what's your sense on the role that philosophical thinking and your disciplinary methodologies can play in taking forward and asking different questions about the nature of pedagogical research or scholarship?
Yeah, nice question, and very relevant to what I was talking about, I guess. So the thing that I've clocked usually when I've said my bit or kind of talked to people from other disciplines, the thing that I get a kind of positive reaction from is my ability to challenge or point out things that are just kind of taken as given or assumptions made, or that, you know, seem to be tacit assumptions or ways of doing things, and to go, why is it like that? And, you know, cliche philosopher just going, well, why? But there is a sort of power to that, to ask these kinds of basic questions, gets people out of the kind of guide rails of their thinking and the guide rails of practice, just repeating the same stuff and same ways of doing things. So the value of, I guess, coming from a discipline like philosophy or similar ones, which is all about kind of critiquing, questioning, and just pulling back and trying to take in a bigger picture and go, okay, what's the sort of underlying thing here that people are missing? I guess that's got loads of value for how to think about teaching better or how to think about assessment better, because you're able to sort of extract, what's the point of all this? And is there something about how we're doing it currently which has kind of lost its way or is kind of obscuring or distorting the thing that's really precious about it in some way? And that's just based on my experience of, I'll have these times when I'll talk to people in other disciplines and I'll go, oh, that's interesting, I've not thought about it like that. I'm going, oh, okay, yeah, okay, maybe all that time doing philosophy hasn't been wasted.
Thanks, Andy.
All right, cheers, Robert, yeah.
Really enjoyed our conversation. I hope it was a useful experience to kind of reflect on your like fellowship and consider.
Yeah, definitely, yeah, it's brilliant. Nice to piece together things.
Good.
Yeah, as I'm talking.
Good. Almost forgot. This is for an audience. Hope you enjoyed listening to the conversation, and we'll include links to any resources in the show notes. Thanks for listening to this episode of Light Bites, and we'll see you next time.